of bells sounds from out behind the house, and I quickly extinguished the lantern. Something tripped an alarm. Jackson is moving toward the back of the house, and Catherine peers out the window. There are people approaching. She turns around, her expression indistinguishable in the dark. They don't look like the dead. I join her at the window, and she's right. A lantern swings back and forth in the night, revealing at least three people. Those ain't shamblers, but I'm betting they're trouble nonetheless. Jackson waves us back toward the bedroom.
The Spencers have a shambler's hole. This way.
We hurry through the house. In the windowless rear bedroom, he flips back the rug, revealing a small door in the floor. He pulls it up and we tumble down into the darkness. I feel around, moving forward until my hands brush against a dirt wall. I half expect to kick something soft and yielding in the dark until Red Jack whispers,
"They ain't down here. This is the first place I checked when I couldn't find them."
I'm wondering why Jackson dragged us out here in the middle of the night if he's already checked the house thoroughly. But there's no time to ask him now. He pulls the trapdoor shut, and the small space is loud with the sound of our breathing. A shambler's hole is a last resort when a homestead gets overrun. Sometimes, hiding out away from the dead for an hour or so can mean the difference between life and undeath. The Spencer's hole was built for a family, so there's more than enough room to move around. I take deep breaths and force my heart to slow. Jackson and Catherine doing the same. Less than a dozen breaths later, the sound of boots on the wooden porch echoes through the house, along with voices. For a moment, I think maybe this is it. Maybe this is my final moment, the scene that leads to my death. But the penny in the hollow of my throat is warm to the touch, and I know that this ain't the end. When it's time for me to die, that penny will be cold. Of that, I have no doubt. The realization is calming, and my heart finally settles down. Someone grabs my hand in the dark and squeezes. I ain't sure whose hand it is, but I squeeze back anyway. Not because I'm scared, but because it just seems like the right thing to do. The boots pause for several long moments before advancing into the house. Once inside, it's a lot easier to decipher what the voices are saying.
"I saw a light on in here. I know I did."
The boots sound closer, walking toward us. They pause over our heads.
"I didn't see anything. You sure you aren't imagining things? You've been skittish ever since we left. Even tripped over that warning alarm like a greenie."
The voice is hoarse and accompanied by a rasping cough. I recognize the second speaker. Someone grabs my arm, hard. I swallow a yelp.
"That's Miss Anderson,"
Catherine whispers, her breath warm on my ear. A feeling, half sick and half rage, blooms in my middle. If Miss Anderson is involved, then I know those folks above can't be up to any good.
"Rupert's got a thing about shamblers,"
a third voice says, low and even.
"Too much time out west in the wide open. He thinks he's safer behind the walls in Baltimore than he is out here."
There are footsteps, and the voice sounds again from a new place.
"Come on, we need to clean out what's left. The mayor wants everything belonging to the Spencers packed up and out of here by morning."
The voices subside, and I lean back against the dirt wall and let myself think.
What did that mean?
Did the Spencers leave of their own accord, or did something happen to them, and these people are trying to cover it up? There's no way to tell, and Jackson looks fit to burst as we listen to the people above move in and out of the house.
"That's it," comes a voice from above after a little while. "We don't need to pack up the bigger furniture. Mayor said just their personal items need to be collected. Now, what are we going to do with the rest of this stuff? Sell it?
There's a cough, and Miss Anderson says,
Have some respect. These aren't pickaninnies we're talking about. The Spencers are a fine, upstanding family.
I clench my hands at the slur rolling off of the lips of one of my instructors. I knew there was a good reason I didn't like that woman. If I could deck her, I would. But I'm trapped in a hole in the dark, so all I can do is listen as she keeps talking.
You and a few of your boys can come back tomorrow and get the rest, she continues. Load it on their pony in the barn and send it along on the next train.
I ain't coming back here again, says Rupert. Are you out of your mind?
Rupert and Miss Anderson start arguing, and the other man finally interrupts.
Quiet, both of you. Rupert grabbed a trunk. Miss Anderson, would you be so kind as to assist me in a visit to the Johnson homestead? The mayor believes Mr. Johnson has been organizing demonstrations in opposition to his run for Senate. And I find that midnight visits elicit the most reliable results.
Of course, Mr. Redfern.
Their footsteps echo as they leave the house. There are a few moments of swearing and thumping as Rupert takes the trunk out. Then silence settles back over the night. The sound of our breathing seems to echo as we wait to make sure the trio is gone. I ain't sure how long we spent in the shambler's hole, but by the time Jackson opens the door, I'm groggy and sorely in need of sleep. He climbs out and comes back with an all clear. I can't see his face in the gloom, but I can tell that he's holding back some feelings by the lack of spring in his step. Who can blame him? We're quiet until we clear the barrier gate. Jackson locks it carefully, even though we all know the Spencers ain't never coming back. Catherine holds herself, cupping her elbows in her palms. Once we're within the shelter of the forest, I clear my throat. It's likely dangerous to talk in the woods, but there are some things that need saying, and no one seems willing to break the silence. Well, I always knew Miss Anderson weren't no good. Catherine's voice comes through the near dark.
So, do you think the Spencers are...
She can't finish the thought, and Jackson can't speak either. Dead, I say finally. Truthfully, I don't know. It was hard to tell from what they were saying, but... Jackson lifts his eyes to mine. I don't think so. The way Miss Anderson was talking about taking care of their things, it sounded like they're still alive, somewhere. What we do know is that wherever they've gone, Miss Anderson and those men she was with were ordered by the mayor to cover it up.
Maybe the Spencers were attacked by a big pack of shamblers, but they weren't bitten, and even though they survived, the mayor doesn't want anyone to know,
Catherine suggests.
He doesn't want people to think Baltimore County is unsafe again. So he packed them up and sent them off somewhere against their will.
I shrug. Maybe. Or maybe they just picked up and moved to a different city on their own. And the mayor doesn't want anyone to know about that either, seeing as how popular they were. We've all heard stories of folks leaving without so much as a how do you do, though not as much recently. Still, they could have found somewhere they liked better than here. Maybe Philadelphia? Wherever it is, it must be pretty nice if they were fine leaving their things behind.
They didn't leave.
Jackson's voice is almost too quiet to hear.
Not on their own. Lily would have gotten word to me.
Maybe she didn't have the chance. It's not like she could tell a message runner that she's your...
You don't know it like I do, Jane, he snaps, even if you always think you do.
I don't say anything to that, because what's the point? He ain't gonna listen to reason. Jackson might not like it, but if the Spencers did move on, at least they didn't leave his sister behind, like unwanted dishes. Well, either way, we need to get on back, I say, after a long moment. The sun's coming up. When I go on my nightly escapades, I'm usually back soon enough to get a bit of sleep. But that's not happening tonight. The sun peeks across the horizon, shading the world gray as dawn approaches. If it takes half as long to get back as it took to get here, we're going to be much later than I'm comfortable with. I start walking.
You can't just leave, Jackson begins behind me. We have to...
Jane? I freeze. My penny has gone ice cold.
What is it?
Jackson says.
Trouble.
An unmistakable groan growl echoes through the trees. Is that? Catherine starts, her voice trailing off. I turn around, searching for the sound. Jackson clears his throat.
On your left, he says, voice low.
I turn, and sure enough, there stands a shambler, lips pulled back in a hungry snarl. It looks like the little white girl I saw along the side of the road a few days back. Guess the patrols didn't take care of her after all. This close, it's easier to see details, like the ragged red ribbons at the ends of her braids and her sickly yellow eyes. She's no more than 9 or 10 years old. I don't recognize her, and that's a mercy. It's hard having to kill the dead you once knew. I take out my sickles, ready to end her, when Catherine makes a choked sound. Bide your time, she says. One of the tenets of defense we've learned at Miss Preston's. I'm ready to snap out something rude when I notice the movement in the trees. Behind the little girl is a whole pack of shamblers, their clothing in tatters, their gray skin hanging loose. There are a few colored folks mixed in with the group, but they mostly look white, scarily nondescript, and similar in that way shamblers get when they've been not dead for a while. From their clothing, they're originals. People that got turned during the first dark days back during the war, before the armies realized that they had a bigger threat to fight than each other. I don't even stop to wonder at a pack this large roaming the woods so close to Baltimore. I just spin my sickles in my hand, relishing their comfortable weight. On my right, Catherine has my spare set of sickles out, and on my left, Red Jack has pulled out a long knife from God knows where. Around my neck, the penny is now cool against my skin, no longer icy. The small shift lets me know that my time ain't up, at least not today. We take a step forward, and the shamblers attack. They're slow and ungainly, tripping over their own feet, tangling in the dense underbrush, dragging themselves along the ground when they can't find their footing. Old shamblers are the best. They've lost enough of their humanity that they're dog-dumb, attacking without any sort of organization. Newer shamblers are as fast as regular people, but the long-dead are like grandmas shuffling along. Their danger comes from the large packs they travel in. Killing 10 people at once may not be difficult for 3 people trained in combat, but it's hard for a lone person green as the grass. I cut down the little girl first. The sickle whistles as it slices through the air, singing in the moments before it separates her head from her body. The gore that gushes out ain't blood, but a thick black ooze. The smell of dead and decaying things is the worst. But this ain't my first waltz, and I keep moving through the pack, letting my blades do the work. My sickles ain't like regular blades that you'd use in the field. Instead of a crescent moon curve, they're a half moon, the blades weighted and sharpened on both sides to easily cut in either direction. They're designed to separate a head from a body, since that's the quickest way to put a shambler down. I like to call this harvesting, because you can't really kill the dead, can you? Plus, it soothes my soul to think I'm doing some good when I end a shambler, sending them on to their well-deserved immortal rest. I cut through a woman in an old-fashioned dress, noticing her long, bedraggled hair more than her features. When her body falls to the ground, I turn to harvest a large man crawling toward me, his mouth opening and closing without making a sound, his clothing that of a field worker. His dark head separates easily from his body. I spin and let my blades cut through the neck of an old white woman lunging for my throat, her stringy gray hair hanging loose. Her slate strands pick up leaves and twigs as her head rolls away from me across the forest floor. It's such an odd detail to notice in the heat of the fight, but that's just how it is sometimes. And then, there is no more movement. I breathe heavily, my sickles and hands covered in the inky mess that is a shambler's blood. Catherine removes the head of a bearded man, shoulders heaving as she searches for any more dead. Jack is bending down and wiping his long knife off on a younger woman's dress. Everyone seems fine. No bites? I ask between heavy breaths as I wipe my hands off on my trouser legs. Both Catherine and Jack shake their heads. All right. I glance at the sky and the increasingly pink horizon. The world had already gone to shades of gray as dawn approached, but now colors are starting to bloom. It didn't take us long to take down the pack, but it was time we didn't have. Me and Kate are going to have to run back to make it before classes start. We need to meet up again to figure out how we're going to deal with this.
What's there to figure out? The Spencers are out there somewhere, and my sister is with them.
Red Jack's jaw is set, and there's a ruthless glint to his eyes that makes me think he's got murder on the mind. That's great and all, but did you hear one clue in that conversation that could tell us for certain that they're still alive, and if so, where they've gone? There's still a lot of country between here and the closest protected city. We set out half-cocked on a rescue mission, we'll get taken down by shamblers before we're 5 steps past the county line.
You say we like you're involved in this, Janie Jane. Like you get a vote.
My temper flares at his dismissive tone. Oh, so now you don't need my help. After I snuck out and spent most of the night huddled in a shambler's hole, you can suddenly handle this all by yourself. You're too good for my blade work. I'd like to carve my initials into his fool face. Jackson's voice is even.
This is my problem, and I'll handle it myself. I trust you ladies can find your way back to your school.
And just like that, Jackson, the boy I once kissed in the moonlight, is gone. Replaced by Red Jack, the ruthless criminal. There ain't no arguing with him once he's got his mind set like this. We'll be fine, I counter. Don't you worry none about us. He gives me a curt nod and bows fluidly to Catherine.
Thank you for accompanying us on our trek this evening. It's nice to know that such a beautiful rose can use her thorns effectively.
Catherine nods and gives a polite smile at the compliment. Without a backward glance in my direction, Jack sets off on his own course through the woods. Catherine looks at me, and I point my sickle behind her. Road. She nods, and we walk. Once our feet hit the hard-packed earth, we set off in a run, settling into a pace just light enough for speech.
These sickles are great. Where did you get them?
I scowl. Catherine would have to ask the one question I don't feel like answering. The set you have came from Jackson.
Keep them. I like these better.
Both sets came from Red Jack, of course. The set that Catherine holds were a birthday present. The set I hold, a parting gift. There is probably something to be said about the fact that the gift I got when he put me aside was nicer. I pick up the pace so that there's no more breath for Catherine's asinine inquiries. My social calendar is always full at Miss Preston's, and the number of fine folks I meet really is a credit to the education I am receiving here. It's true that being a Negro has its drawbacks, but I couldn't tell you what they are. That's how happy I am being taught my place here at Miss Preston's. I may not ever get to be a debutante, but catering to the fine white women of Baltimore is a far more worthy endeavor. Chapter 10, in which I receive an unwelcome invitation and am forced to accept it. Catherine and I managed to get back to school, wash up, and change without being discovered. We miss breakfast, and when Miss Duncan asks where we were, Catherine sheepishly says we both overslept and got to our chores late. The excuse works, mostly because everyone knows that Catherine and I don't really get on well. No one would expect her to lie to protect me. I sleepwalk through the day. I'm dog tired, and my body feels twice as heavy as we do our scythe work. There are no fine ladies to watch us today, so the drills are tolerable. After the midday meal, we practice shooting, and even though I'm hitting my target, my aim is off. Miss Folsom, the firearms teacher, scowls at my shot grouping.
Jane, this is sloppy work. Watch your trigger squeeze, girl. An inch isn't such a big deal at close range, but with a rifle, that inch becomes several feet.
Yes, ma'am, I say, swallowing a yawn. My only consolation is that Catherine is just as mutton-headed as I am. She drops her sickles during our close combat class, and Miss Anderson wraps her ruler on Catherine's knuckles when she dozes off during our tea-serving lesson. It ain't Christian to revel in the misery of others, but I like to make an exception for Catherine. After our final class of the day, I drop off my weapons at the armory and get ready to head to my bed, using my study time to doze before dinner. If I don't get some sleep, I'm going to pass out in my soup. I've just lain down and started to snooze when someone shakes me awake.
The building better be on fire, I grumble.
Miss Preston wants to see us. Catherine sounds as tired as I feel, and I groan as I climb out of bed and follow her down the hall. We drag ourselves into the headmistress's office. All my exhaustion slips away when I see Miss Anderson and the big Indian man from the lecture standing there. Miss Preston is nowhere to be found. I straighten, and the man's gaze slips over me. Even with the corners of his mouth pulled down in distaste, he's eye-catching. I try to imagine him with feathers in his dark hair and wearing beaded buckskin like in the newspaper serials. I just can't do it. The clothes he wears, homespun shirt and trousers, suit him. He doesn't look much older than me and Catherine, his brown skin unlined. I wonder if he went to the Indian school up in Pennsylvania, and if he did, how it compares to Miss Preston's. I don't know much about how the Indian schools work, but I've heard they're less focused on teaching folks how to kill the dead than they are civilizing them, whatever that means. It makes me curious about that impassive man's life. Did he come here to Baltimore to seek his fortune, or is he here against his will? A racking cough pulls my attention away from my perusal of the Indian man. Miss Anderson wheezes as she coughs, a handkerchief pressed to her lips. Miss Anderson, are you well? You don't sound so good. She gives one last cough and shoots me an arsenic-laced glare.
My health is of no concern to you, Jane McKean.
Well, I just hope it ain't tuberculosis. The nights have been chilly this year, and it wouldn't take much for a cough to become something more if you'd been out in the cold. I can feel Catherine's glare, and the man raises an eyebrow in my direction, but I keep my expression mild. Auntie Aggie used to say I was like as not to poke Satan with a stick just for fun. Guess not much has changed. Mostly, I'm just thinking about Miss Anderson being in cahoots with the mayor and whatever he's done with Lily and the Spencers, as well as her comment about pickaninnies and every mean-spirited thing she's done to me. It takes all the self-restraint I have to keep from launching myself at her and beating her senseless. But I'm saved from doing anything untoward by Miss Preston entering the room. She takes in the tableau before her and frowns.
Is something amiss?
No, ma'am, Catherine says, a smile breaking out over her face, making her look like an angel from a painting. My anger and disgust grows a little more, fed by a mean streak of envy. I grit my teeth and say nothing. Catherine didn't pick the face she was born with, and it ain't her fault her perfect smile makes me want to break things. My dark feelings are my own problem, and I aim to keep them that way. Miss Preston sits heavily in her chair with a sigh.
Well, then, I suppose we should get to the reason as to why we're here.
She shuffles through a stack of papers on her desk and pulls out a lovely cream-colored vellum envelope.
In recognition of your heroics at the Baltimore University lecture, the mayor's wife has invited you girls to a formal dinner. A few of her close friends have lost their attendance lately, and she would like you to augment her household staff in order to guarantee her guests' safety.
Catherine gives me a wide-eyed look, but I don't feel any of the excitement I see on her face. The penny under my blouse has gone cold. Miss Preston continues.
This is an excellent opportunity to present yourself to the finest ladies in all of Maryland. Miss Anderson and Mr. Redfern here will be taking you to be fitted for attendance where? At Mayor Carr's expense, of course. Miss Anderson will also be accompanying you to dinner as your chaperone to ensure that you represent the school with dignity and honor.
My penny is a snowball at the hollow of my neck, and I ain't at all encouraged by Miss Preston glossing over the fact that multiple Baltimore attendants have been killed, presumably within the city limits. All my anger at whatever Miss Anderson and the mayor have done with Lily and the Spencers disappears, replaced by fear. I'm shaky and out of sorts as I take a deep breath and let it out.
Miss Preston, I'm honored by the invitation, but I'm afraid I must decline.
My words come out too fast, my tongue tripping over syllables. I see my end in this fine invitation, and I ain't a hog to go happily to the slaughter, no matter how pretty the acts. Miss Preston opens her mouth to speak, and I continue, in an attempt to cover my lack of grace and decorum. What I mean is, it would be terrible of us to accept such a generous offer without including Miss Duncan. She was instrumental in putting down the restless dead, and I just don't feel right taking advantage of such an invitation without her.
I'm sure our honorable mayor would be happy to include your teacher as well.
Mr. Redfern's voice is a low rumble, and I barely manage to keep myself from jumping in surprise. I'd forgotten he was even standing there in the corner, as intent as I was on not ending up at the mayor's dinner. Miss Preston smiles.
Well, it's settled then. You girls will be excused from classes tomorrow for your fitting, and next week you will attend dinner at the mayor's residence.
Miss Preston levels a withering look at me.
Try to conduct yourselves in a matter befitting a Miss Preston's girl. After all, a contract with a good family is the difference between a future and, well,
she trails off, giving us knowing smiles.
Thank you, Miss Preston. We are doubly blessed, and we will not let you down,
Catherine chirps in answer, all but bouncing as we take our leave. Behind us, Miss Preston asks Mr. Redfern in a low voice,
Have you or the mayor heard anything further on the Edgar's disappearance?
I whirl around,
perhaps too quickly considering that I ain't supposed to know anything about missing families, but I meet Miss Anderson's eyes. Her smug expression convinces me to keep on walking out of the room and unleashes a barrage of worry that unsettles my stomach. She's got the look of a cat that just caught a mouse. No wonder I feel like squeaking. Mama, I do hope you'll share news of Rose Hill in your next letter. How is everyone? Did the cabbages and okra do well this year? Do you still love me? No. Do you still regret having me? No. Do you miss me half as much as I miss you? Chapter 11, in which I remember Rose Hill and my mama's sworn enemy. That night, exhausted and preoccupied with the mayor's untimely invitation, I do the same thing I always do when I'm fretful. I dream of Rose Hill and of Rachel, the only person I ever knew to hate my mama. My mama is an unusual woman. She didn't much like the whole concept of slavery, no matter how honorable it was, and there were rumors that she was sore disappointed with her husband, the major, when he left her to fight for the Confederacy. But the strangest thing about Mama, the thing that made some of the neighbors smile tightly and alienated all the rest, is Mama's rumored penchant for field hands. The stronger, the darker, the better. They said she took them to bed like some kind of plantation Delilah, stealing their strength in order to keep herself young and strong. It wasn't true, but that didn't stop tongues from wagging. I discovered later that even before I was born, Mama had a reputation for going out and buying the worst of the worst at the auctions. The runaways, the dullards, the cheapest, lousiest Negroes you could find. It was how she spent her time, buying up as many folks as she could, and rumor was she damn near bankrupted her and the major doing it. If there was a mother and her children on the block, she would buy the whole lot, cutting a deal with the auctioneers before the family ever went up for bidding. Neighbors would joke, "I'm gonna sell you my girl, Bella. She ain't worth a lick." And the next thing you know, Bella would be in the kitchen baking bread. Mama never let the slave patrols on the property, even when they were chasing down a neighbor's runaway. And the one time the fellas did trespass, she had the kennel master set the dogs on them. It was an all-around curious way of doing business, but Mama was rich enough that the neighbors didn't say much. Not long after I was born, everyone in the county pretty much suspected Mama had birthed me, the height of scandal in a place like Haller County, Kentucky. During the beginning of the years of discord, Mama made it her business to always help a neighbor in need, especially as Rose Hill flourished. So most folks found Mama's peccadilloes less important than her willingness to ride out with a team and help clear a field of debt. And if folks could overlook the rumors of a white woman birthing a Negro, well, they could forgive just about anything, couldn't they? It was something I didn't much know about or understand until I was old enough to read and to learn how to eavesdrop properly. The first time I ever realized that a white woman keeping time with a colored man was cause for scandal, I was 6 or 7. And the only reason I ever knew of my mother's transgressions was because of Rachel, who hated my mama more than anyone else in the world. Rachel was mad that day she got to flapping her gums because Auntie Aggie had set her to peeling potatoes, a task that she thought was beneath her. In Rachel's mind, every ill that befell her was the work of someone else. In this case, Mama, who had told Auntie Aggie that she wanted a nice mashed potato with dinner. "You know the missus weren't no lady afore she married the major now, don't you? She ain't nothing but rabble. She ain't got no class like Mrs. Hooper, my first mistress, God rest her soul." Rachel had no love for my mama. All her loyalty was for the major. The major had bought Rachel from a plantation down the way before he went off to the war, and she always liked to say how Mama wasn't doing things right. Not enough whippings, not enough discipline, too many Negroes forgetting their place. Rachel had a set way as to how things should have been on Rose Hill, and in Rachel's mind, Mama was too soft because she didn't play favorites and she didn't hand out nearly enough beatings. One of the other aunties, Auntie Eliza, once told me it was because Rachel was the major's favorite before he went to war, and she liked the easy life he gave her. Rachel had adjusted to being owned, to being property, and she didn't like the new situation where she wasn't nothing but a house servant with wages, a servant that had to work just as hard as everyone else. Slavery had been illegal since the Great Concession, that famous day President Jefferson Davis and the remaining Confederate states surrendered so that President Lincoln would issue the writ of concession, sending General Ulysses Grant and the Union troops on their famous march across the South, burning every shambler and abandoned homestead they found, and saving Dixie from utter ruin. Slavery had come to an end thanks to President Lincoln and the undead plague. But there were still folks like Rachel that didn't quite know what to do with all that freedom. At the time, I had no idea why Rachel was so angry, but I figured it was like how Mama always made sure I ate dinner with her, and how she taught me how to read in the evenings, while the other kids got to go play or help fix the barrier fences that kept out the shamblers. Rachel had been special when the major was around, and now she wasn't. But Auntie Aggie said that Rachel couldn't help the way she was, that she'd had a hard life before she came to Rose Hill, and the only way she knew how to act was a vicious kind of way. Surviving can make people right mean, Auntie Aggie told me. You stay away from that viper. She don't have nothing but ill will towards you and your mama. But I couldn't avoid Rachel all the time. The kitchens were where I spent most of my day, since Mama didn't want me out beyond the interior fence, especially after what happened to poor Zeke. So I got to hear more of Rachel's gossiping than I cared to. The missus was nothing but trash, singing for coin, before the major lifted her up to being something. And look at how she repays him, rolling around with field darkies like the whore of Babylon. There's an order to things, Rachel said, giving me a hard look where I stood, helping Auntie Eliza knead bread. Rachel thought there was a hierarchy that should be followed. Field workers, house slaves, mistress, and master. It didn't matter that we were all free. That Mama made sure to pay everyone a small wage each week for their hard work. The bad old ways were still alive and well in Rachel's brain, and anything that flaunted that order was a terrible thing. Like me. That's the reason the dead don't stay down, you know. The whole world is turned upside down. Darkies are free as white folks, don't know their place anymore. If they did, maybe things would go back to normal. She uses that word one more time, and I'm going to throttle her, Auntie Eliza said, giving Rachel a hard look. Auntie Eliza's husband worked out in the fields, and no one talked bad about the field workers when she was around. You ain't the only one, muttered Auntie Betsy, who was plucking a chicken. No one much liked Rachel, but she didn't let that stop her from carrying on. Mark my words, when the major come home, that woman is going to be in for a rude awakening. That's all I'm saying. There's going to be a reckoning when the major comes back. She kept peeling potatoes and tapping her foot as though she'd like nothing more than to run right out the door. And maybe, if Rachel had left, things wouldn't have been so bad when the major finally did return, 8 years after the end of the war between the states, and smack dab in the midst of the years of discord, bringing a discord all his own to Rose Hill Plantation. When I wake in the morning, alone in my bedroom at Miss Preston's, groggy and with memories of the treacherous Rachel scratching at my brain, I'm in an even worse mood. But more than that, I am certain that nothing good can come of this dinner at the mayor's house. Why else would I have dreamed of Rachel, the woman that almost got me and my mama killed. The curriculum at Miss Preston's stresses loyalty, and I have to say that my dedication to my fellow students is incomparable. Of course, they share my sentiments. I dare say that there is not a thing Miss Preston's girls won't do for one another. Chapter 12, in which I become an unwilling co-conspirator. The fittings go without incident. I fidget all the way to the dressmaker's and back, expecting at any moment the driver will pull the iron pony over and Miss Anderson and Mr. Redfern will slaughter us for what we know. But despite the tension I sensed in Miss Preston's office, they seemed completely unconcerned with both the upcoming dinner party and with me and Catherine. That doesn't ease my worry, though. They could just be playing the long game, biding their time, waiting to end me and Catherine until after I've relaxed my guard. None of that makes any sense. If they somehow suspected we'd been there at the Spencers, we'd likely know already. But that's the way it is with panic. It takes you by the throat and doesn't much listen to reason. Days go by, and after turning the events of the previous week over in my head, I can't decide how I feel about the mystery of Lily and the Spencers. The longer we go without word from them, the more disconcerting the lack of news. But then, the more days pass without any further panic or shambler sightings, the more likely it seems the Spencers simply did leave for another city, whether by choice or by force. It's an unsettling conundrum, and I don't like it one bit. It sure would set my mind at ease if Lily were to find a way to tell us what happened. By the afternoon before the mayor's dinner party, Catherine's anxiety seems to have retreated into the background as well, and she is beside herself with excitement. She chatters about it to the other girls, and when they tire of listening to her, she finds me and talks my ear off. What do you think Mrs. Carr will wear? I wish we could wear a corset or even a bustle. She flips the pages in her catalog and settles down next to me in the grass. I'm sitting under the big oak out back, what my mama used to call a hanging tree. The branches spread apart and thick and grow in parallel to the ground. A tree perfect for climbing or stringing up a man. When I first got to Miss Preston's, I used to run off and hide in the branches of this tree, climbing as high as I could and hiding amongst the dense boughs. Eventually, Miss Anderson discovered my hiding spot. She waited until I finally came down, taking the strap to me so bad that I couldn't sit for a week. Maybe that's why there ain't no love lost between me and the woman. Even my earliest bad memories of the school are tied to her. Catherine nudges me. See? They've modified it so it collapses and you can sit down. Isn't that just marvelous? And look at the silhouette. She thrusts the fashion catalog at me so that I can see the bustle, which juts out of the rear of the woman's hips and makes her look like a demented wasp. I push the catalog away. Where'd you get that? Catherine gives me a long look before sniffing indignantly. Really, Jane? As though you're the only one to smuggle in contraband. Everyone has a little something. You're just the only one who gets caught. I cover my face with my hands and pray to the Lord above for strength. Kate, has it occurred to you how odd it is that the mayor would invite us to a formal dinner just like that? It's been over 2 weeks since the lecture, and he didn't seem to think much of our heroics until a week later. Not to mention the fact that he's embroiled in some scandal involving the Spencers. She gives me a narrowed-eyed look and sighs, pulling back her catalog and flipping through the pages. I don't find it odd at all. He's obviously a busy man, and his wife is known for the care and dedication she takes when planning the details of her soirees. Anyway, how do you know the mayor didn't help the Spencers start a new life somewhere fine? All this panic is completely unnecessary. Besides, we'll be there as attendants, not as real guests. It's not at all the same.
Her gaze gets all dreamy and far away.
I wonder how many courses there will be. My mother went to a dinner once where they had 17 courses. 17. She said by the end she was so stuffed she could barely even taste the food. Can you imagine?
I perk up at the mention of Catherine's mom. She's as much a mystery amongst the girls at Miss Preston's as my own mother.
Is that so? Does your mother go to a lot of dinner parties?
Catherine's expression shudders, and she bends back down to her magazine.
A few. What about your mother, Jane?
Her tone is mild, but it's clear she's avoiding my question.
Oh, my mama's been to a few.
None since the last dinner party held at Rose Hill Plantation, though. It was just after the major returned, battle-weary and grim, talking about the end of the world and God's judgment. Mama sat me next to her at the table during the dinner, as she always did, stroking my hair like a favorite pet. The neighbors were used to this behavior since they'd been to dinner at Rose Hill a number of times. It seemed normal to all of us, but the major's expression grew stormy throughout the courses. When Mama had me grab the Bible after dessert to read a few passages to the neighbors, the major's simmering temper exploded.
You taught a darky to read? Have you lost your goddamn mind, Ophelia?
He screamed while the neighbors watched bug-eyed. Mama sent me off to Auntie Aggie to get tucked into bed before she escorted the neighbors out, making excuses for the major, talking about the stress of the war and the horror of watching half of your regiment get slaughtered, only to rise up and start eating the other half. The neighbors nodded and made polite clucking noises as they walked to their iron ponies. They believed my mama, but they hadn't felt the way she tensed when the major yelled, or the way she gripped my arms when he called me a darky. I was old enough to know that things were about to get bad at Rose Hill, but I wasn't afraid of the major. No, I'd seen what happened when mama didn't get her way. It never ended well. 2 days later, the major was a shambler with a bullet in his skull, and I had my first harvest at 10 years old.
Jane, are you even listening?
Catherine's sigh jolts me from my reverie. There's an ache in my chest from thinking about my mama for too long, and I curse myself for getting lost in the past. Now I'm going to be maudlin for the next few days, remembering times gone by. This is why it's better not to think about Rose Hill at all.
Jane!
What?
I do believe that's Jackson waving to you from the tree line.
I glance up, and sure enough, there's Red Jack, jumping around on the other side of the barrier fence like he hasn't got a lick of sense. I shake my head and point him toward the back of the school, through the trees to the old slave cabin. We used to meet back there when we were something more than uneasy friends, and I hope he remembers this spot. If anyone from the house sees him, they're going to wonder why a boy is tromping around the school grounds, and I'll be in hot water. I wait a full minute or so before climbing to my feet and going to the back of the yard. Catherine stays put, flipping pages and muttering to herself about my inability to appreciate good fashion. The sound of fighting comes from the practice grounds as I cut toward the back of the property. The younger girls have their first evaluations coming up at the end of the month. How they rate will determine their rankings, and those rankings will one day make the difference between eking out a living on one of the mayor's cleanup crews or an assignment as a ladies' attendant, offering protection and companionship while living the good life. I manage to make my way to the barrier fence without discovery, and Red Jack is there, leaning against the tall wrought iron and looking like he hasn't a care in the world. His nonchalance is belied by his split lip, swollen eye, and the blood dotting the front of his waistcoat. Uh-oh.
Did Harvey Parker finally catch you fooling around with his wife?
Jackson scowls at me.
Very funny. No, this is what happens when you try to sneak into Mayor Carr's estate.
You went trespassing at the mayor's? Near as I figure, you're lucky to still be breathing.
That's the same thing his boys told me. Luckily, one of them is a fan of the dog races, and he did me a favor in exchange for making sure a few of the well-known puppies never make it to the track to run again.
Red Jack winces as he shifts his weight from one foot to the other, hand holding his side.
Catherine gasps, stealing up behind us like a shambler in the night, me near to jumping out of my skin from the surprise. I scowl at her, but she ignores me.
You aren't going to kill a dog, are you? That's awful.
Jackson raises a single brow at her.
Of course not. I ain't a monster. There are lots of kids in the city who'd like to claim a stray as their own, that's all. And you'd be surprised how easy it is to switch out a winner for a similar-looking loser.
You came all the way here, half-broken, just to tell me that the mayor's boys almost stomped you into mush and that you're planning on fixing a few races in the future? I ask, interrupting. I ain't at all endeared to the friendliness between Jackson and Catherine. It's petty, but I'm okay with that.
Jackson shifts slightly and sighs.
You heard those people at the Spencers? Mayor Carr has something to do with Lily's disappearance. I need to get into his house and figure out what.
I open my mouth to offer some paltry platitude when I'm interrupted by Catherine saying,
maybe we could help. We're going there for dinner.
I shoot Catherine my best, are you stupid, Claire? But Jackson's already perked up.
Going where for dinner? Mayor Carr's?
Catherine nods, bouncing up onto the balls of her feet and back down again.
Yes, we got invited to this fancy dinner party on account of saving so many folks at the lecture a couple of weeks ago.
Jackson looks at me and I shake my head. We're going as attendants, fancy servants with sharp weapons. But you didn't want our aid before, and we ain't gonna have time to help now with whatever poppycock plan you dream up. Plus, I ain't so sure this whole invite is on the up and up. We'll have our hands full just taking care of ourselves.
Catherine sighs heavily. You have such a morbid outlook, Jane. That doesn't make any sense. Good attendant positions aren't getting any easier to land. This is a real opportunity.
Nothing those survivalists offer is an opportunity, I mutter. When are you two supposed to go?
Red Jack asks, a familiar twinkle in his eye. He is planning something, and whatever it is ain't going to be good.
Tomorrow, Catherine says. We even got new dresses. It is going to be quite the event.
Jackson nods, and just like that, I know I'm in for some kind of mischief. I glance at Catherine, hoping maybe I can convince her this is a terrible idea. But she's just giving Red Jack this friendly grin, and I bury my face in my hands. Despite my best intentions, I'm about to be sucked into some kind of high drama.
I am surrounded by nothing but suicidal mutton heads.
Mama, I do believe that the manners and etiquette taught at Miss Preston's may be some of the best instruction in the whole state of Maryland, if not all of the United States. Honestly, where else do Negro girls get to truly learn their place, serving the fine white folks of the world and keeping them safe?
Chapter 13, in which I attend a rather eventful dinner. The mayor's iron pony picks us up at 4:30. Dinner is to begin at 5:30 with cocktails, and Miss Anderson doesn't want to be late. There's murder in her eyes when she talks about how grand the mayor's dinner is going to be, and the wide smile she gives when Catherine and I climb into the passenger compartment does not help the anxiety clawing its way through my guts. Not one bit.
Catherine is chatty as a magpie on the way to the mayor's house, and even Miss Duncan looks a bit fatigued from attempting to share in her good humor. Catherine, however, is plain radiant. Her gold-streaked curls are swept into an attendant's bun high on her head. Escaped ringlets soften the harsh style. Her attendant's formal dress is a pale pink that complements her golden skin perfectly and falls to her knees. The undertrousers are a darker pink, and the stockings and boots are cream. Her white gloves, which I refuse to wear because they made my hands feel clumsy, are effortlessly elegant. A jab of jealousy hits me every time I look over at her. She looks like some kind of delicious confection. Nobody needs to be that pretty, especially in silly attendance garb. My dark thoughts are misplaced, though. It's only because of Catherine's help that I ain't looking too bad myself. My attendance garb is done in shades of green. The dress is an emerald that sets off the deep bronze of my skin in a very nice way. While the under trousers are a lighter shade, my stockings striped green and white, and my boots brown. I've never had such a lovely dress. The fit snug enough to let me fight, yet modest enough not to cause scandal. My sickles, the fancy ones from Red Jack, not the ungainly practice ones from school, are strapped into a fine leather belt tooled to carry such things. The holster on the belt empty, since Mayor Carr doesn't much care for guns in his estate. There are even pockets sewn into the skirt, a request the dressmaker was happy to oblige, and I've hidden Tom Sawyer in one, just in case I find time to read some later. Catherine helped me do something with my stubborn curls, using a pair of hot tongs to subdue the mess into the required attendance bun. When she'd showed me what she'd done in the mirror, I'd laughed. Well, look at that. I look right proper. Don't worry, Jane. You could never pass for proper, Catherine had said, her tone teasing instead of harsh. Wonder of all wonders, I do believe we are becoming friends. We arrive at the mayor's estate safe and sound, which is somewhat of a surprise, what with all of Catherine's talking and what I am certain is impending doom in Miss Anderson's treacherous eyes. We get out, and Catherine takes a deep breath. Jane, look at it. It's breathtaking. Mayor Carr's house is quite impressive. The barrier fence that surrounds the grounds is made of wrought iron at least 10 feet tall, and I wonder how Jackson was able to scale such a high fence. Dogs patrol the grass around the property, sniffing the ground. I've heard of such dogs. They're similar to the dogs the slave patrols used to hunt down runaways in the old days. These dogs are trained to alert on shamblers, barking loudly and getting right vicious when they smell the undead. But right now, they just look like normal floppy-eared dogs. Still, I make a point not to get too close. The house itself is monstrously huge. It's equally as big as our school. But tobacco fields, not woodland, surround the back acreage. The mayor's house is newer and made of a white stone that rises up 4 stories, the roof topped by a plethora of cupolas and gables, looking very fancy and imposing. But there's something else here that catches my eye, something even more impressive than the size of the house. Electric lights. I've seen electricity before, of course. Word of Mr. Edison's experiments in New Jersey had made their way down the eastern seaboard, and there had even been a demonstration a year or so back here in Baltimore. I've never heard of them installed in a private home, though. And yet here they are, lighting up the pathway to the entrance. I couldn't help but stare. This is the house of a man used to being followed and obeyed. A man who has enough people between him and the shambler threat to never feel fear. Miss Anderson and Miss Duncan lead the way up the front walk. Catherine and I keep a few paces behind, as taught. She walks with the grace and carriage of a true lady. I slouch along, hands resting on the hilts of my sickles, ready to draw them at the first sign of trouble. Both of our instructors wear sedate, dove gray